Hey there, my name is Sam Okus. I am the editor-in-chief at Nation's Restaurant News, bringing you a very special edition of the Extra Serving podcast. That's right, this week we are thrilled to go live with NRN's Top 500 list, giving you a definitive look at restaurant chain performance in 2020. We have partnered with Data Central and its Firefly 500 platform on this year's Top 500, and it is chock full of insights that can help you benchmark your own brand's performance and strategize for the year ahead. But we are not stopping there. To dig in just a little deeper on how brands fared in 2020, each day this week, right here on the Extra Serving feed, we are going to provide you with an exclusive interview with a brand leader on how they managed to succeed in 2020 and how they're emerging from the pandemic even stronger than before. These snapshots of success give you exclusive access to the winning strategies that are helping restaurant companies navigate uncharted waters, and hopefully will provide you with the ideas for tackling challenges you face in your own business. Stay tuned for more snapshots of success, not only every day this week, but also in the coming weeks and months ahead as we explore what exactly went right for those brands that closed 2020 with positive stories to tell. So be sure to subscribe to the Extra Serving podcast on Spotify, Apple, wherever you listen to podcasts, and we will be feeding you with those stories, with those interviews, with executives from some of the top 500 brands. Also, be sure to head to NRN.com to catch up on all of our top 500 coverage, including a robust data package with sales and unit count information for the nation's top 500 chain restaurants. And now, let's roll into today's Snapshots of Success interview from NRN's 2021 Top 500.
Hi there, I'm Lisa Jennings, Executive Editor with Nation's Restaurant News. In today's installment of NRN's Top 500 Snapshots of Success series, I'm talking to Ashley Morris, CEO of the Las Vegas-based fast casual sandwich chain Capriotti's, home of the Bobby. Morris tells us how the company ran headfirst into its problems in 2020 and turned things around. The brand acquired Wingzone this year and has exciting plans for turning that into a tech-forward concept.
So we have Capriotti's as a success story. Looking at the numbers for 2020, it was a great year. And the system-wide sales, domestic sales were up 9.5%. The company has reported double-digit sales, same-store sales increases. They've added 18 units in 2020, which was an 18% increase, so for a total of 114 at the end of the year. And of course, the big news for Capriotti's was earlier this year, the acquisition of Wingzone.
Yes.
So, Ashley, thanks for joining me. And maybe you can let us know a little bit about what it was that Capriotti's did last year that made it such a success.
Sure. So, kind of to start, obviously, look, COVID has been a devastating thing for many businesses. And I think, when we it became real to us, my business partner has been my best buddy for a really long time. He's the data junkie out of the two of us. And, he started consuming a large amount of data around COVID, probably around November, December of 18. And so he was ringing the alarm bells, in January and February, and I wasn't even necessarily hearing him as loud and clear as I probably should have been. Come February, it became real. And, very quickly into March, we had, governments and governors and the federal government shutting down cities across the country. And when that happened, we experienced the same kind of same store sales declines that, my expectation is that most businesses experience right from the get-go. So early March, we were tracking for the year up double digits, and all of a sudden we were experiencing 35 to 40% same store sales decreases. And we did 1 week of that. We had 15 stores in our chain immediately closed by government mandate and could not do any business at all. And so we were hit by it. And it led us to go through an exercise internally about cash flow. Our assumption was we did not know how long this was going to last. The best information we were hearing was this was going to be a global pandemic for sure till the end of the year, and possibly beyond, and that there was really, right then, early March, no end in sight. And so it was one of those times where we had to take a really hard look at the business and say, are we even going to survive? Are we even going to be here? And do we have enough cash to survive? And So we quickly went into an exercise about cash and cash management, and you know, learned that we had about enough cash to survive the year. And at the end of the year, you know, if nothing changed, that we would be raising capital probably, you know, mid-year to continue to support the business. And that's assuming, right, franchisees don't pay royalties and stores, you know, experience a 50% decline in sales, all the machinations of the horrible universe that could be in front of us. And so in doing so, one of the mentors in my life who have been substantial mentor for the last 12 years of my life, he told me when we were going through the global financial crisis in 08, he said to me something profound. I think I was, kind of in full breakdown about what was going on. You know, the capital markets had just frozen. We were newly into owning Capriotis. We had just made the acquisition. We had all these grandiose plans, and now no franchisee could get capital. And the capital markets were frozen. He said, look, run headfirst into your problems. If you make a habit and you make a commitment to yourself that no matter what problem you have, you run headfirst into it and you don't run away from it, you don't shy away from it, you don't pretend it doesn't exist, I promise you, you will save time, you will save money, and you will solve things that you would not have normally been able to solve, and the problem will become insurmountable if you don't deal with it. And that stuck with me. It was an incredible piece of advice that really did stick with me. And so in thinking about COVID, we have now found ourselves again, you know, in a position where you know, the world has happened to us, so to speak. You know, we didn't start this thing. It wasn't because we did something wrong, and now our brand was in jeopardy of potentially not being here. And so I heard him in the back of my, brain saying, run headfirst into it. And so we kind of made the decision as a team. I said, look, we're going to be raising capital midsummer anyways, you know, and run out of money by the end of the year. Then we might as well try to run headfirst into this. Let's spend the most amount of money we can spend. Let's spend 2 full months of cash flow on a marketing plan. And let's just see what happens. And maybe, just maybe, you know, we are positioned well to deliver. We are positioned for off-premise. We are positioned for omni-channel ordering. We had the apps in place. We had the aggregators in place. We have all the pieces. Let's just see if we can't remind the world that we're available and we're open. And so we spent $250,000 on a local store marketing campaign in Nevada, in Las Vegas only, over a 10-day period. And so I know 250 doesn't really sound like a tremendous amount of money, compared to what national brands really spend, but it was spent over 10 days in one market, right?
Where you have the most units, right?
Well, you do have 40 restaurants there. And so that's why we decided to test it. It was our own money. It wasn't franchisee money. And, you know, because so many advertisers had pulled their advertising because they were forced by government mandate to close, right? So car dealerships and all these other places that couldn't actually do business, they pulled all their advertising smartly. The advertisers were willing to give us kind of 2-for-1 on our dollars.
Interesting.
And so the 250 was really worth about 500. And so we said, let's go. And so over 10 days, we launched a campaign that was in such magnitude for what it was. You know, it was outsized. Like every single channel, every single day was seeing our commercial 3 or 4 or 5 times a day, right? Like, and our assumptions were at the time that everyone was sitting home watching TV, right? Because nobody really knew what was happening. And so we haven't really used the TV channel until, you know, very, very, very infrequently have we used TV as a vehicle, but we did in this particular case. And the first week we launched it, so we had that negative 40% same store sales. Then the next week we launched the advertising, we had about a negative 30% same store sales. And the following week we were tracking up. We literally turned the sales from negative to positive in just having a third of the chain go up so significantly. And then of course, when we saw those results, we rolled them immediately across the country. And so we then just continued to forward invest in advertising as hard and fast as we could. All around the country, and it started to lift all the restaurants that could remain open. It started to lift them significantly. Now, were there, you know, casualties? Absolutely. We have a store very close to Las Vegas Boulevard. You know, that store got cut more than half, and no marketing was going to solve that issue because nobody was coming to Vegas, right? And so, you know, the store in Chicago, right? You know, when downtown Chicago is closed and no one's allowed to be there, no amount of advertising is going to support that. But the vast majority of the stores really benefited from that. And that, I believe, was the critical linchpin for us to quickly weather the storm and put ourselves and our franchise partners in a position where they were still doing sales, making money, and able to pay all of their bills. And so, and pay their royalties. And so that was really, you know, if you were going to say one thing we did right, that was really the thing we did right. And it worked. It just worked really, really, really well.
Right.
And so once that kind of happened, we moved out of the thinking about what do we need to do to survive? What do we need to do to stay in business? We moved from that thinking to, okay, we know we're going to be in business. We know we're going to survive. And we know the vast majority of our units are going to continue to be open. Now, how do we win? How do we go out and do something extraordinary inside of a, you know, a situation that's terrible? And so we immediately thought that's where we should put our focus, to look for other brands that are also doing well organically through COVID, that are positioned for to-go and off-premise and you know, those kinds of places. Obviously, fast food, QSR is where we're, you know, where we live today and where our expertise and acumen is. So we wanted to stay there. And we wanted to try to find another brand that we could acquire. And so we immediately, probably around May of 19, I started looking for brands to acquire. And that's where we found Wing Zone.
And Wing Zone offering the wings that everybody seemed to be craving through COVID, yeah, for one, but also tenders and burgers.
Yeah. I mean, obviously we know chicken is trending and it's continued to be on trend. I had not understood the magnitude of wings that quickly. You know, in May, it wasn't this like insane J curve of demand. But we very much liked the wing space, you know, based on the set of circumstances of having, you know, one major player in the space. There really isn't a number two, a definitive number two out there. And so we thought, hey, if we got into this space, we could very well use our expertise and use our infrastructure to create kind of that undisputed number two, you know, chain in the category. And so, you know, when we looked at Wing Zone, we were seeing the same things. We were seeing franchisee success in the stores that were not closed by government mandate. We were seeing positive same store sales, and the chain had two founders that had been doing this for almost 30 years and were ready to retire. And so it was just very fortuitous that all kind of the stars aligned and you know, we were able to put a deal together.
So let me bring you back to Capriati's though. Sure. And as you were doing this marketing, so you've rolled out this campaign, you're starting to turn things around in terms of results for your franchisees, but you said you had started looking at off-premise and creating the infrastructure that you needed for that. But tell me what you did during 2020 that really expanded on your ability to do delivery and catering and the other things that you benefited from.
Yeah. I mean, look, catering almost went away.
Right.
Yeah. You know, that literally went away overnight. And catering historically for Capriati's has been about 12 to 15% of the business. But one of the things that we did locally and that was amazing is some of the local, city council workers and politicians that were in our market were starting to feed hospitals and feed first responders and, you know, there was so much of that momentum there that we were able that they reached out to us and said, hey, we want to, you know, serve Capriati's in all the hospitals in Delaware and Las Vegas and so forth. And so we were able to, you know, be in a good position to support that, which was helpful in terms of sales. But beyond that, you know, really just having our brand historically set up for omnichannel, you know, for the last 10 years, we've seen technology come through the restaurant space and it's completely and utterly disruptive, but it is disruptive generally in a positive way if you were willing to embrace it. And, you know, again, credit to my business partner, and who's the president of our company. He's always been the technology guy. He's always been the tech focused, open-minded, you know, ready to evolve on a dime kind of thinker. And because of that, you know, it's allowed me to really kind of see the game differently. And so, you know, 10 years ago when apps became a thing, he's like, we got to get an app, right? And I'm like, who knows if apps are really a thing? No, you got to just listen to me. Okay, I'm listening to you, let's go. And so, you know, through the time, online ordering, you know, all the app type stuff, everything, all the technology, the customer experience technology that has been available, we've embraced, including delivery aggregators. And so early on, when Grubhub and DoorDash, Postmates, et cetera, Uber Eats, when they became a thing, we embraced it very quickly. And we quickly realized, rather than kind of fight that trend, you know, we should figure out how to optimize that trend. And so we did. And in optimizing that trend, you know, we were able to, you know, we pass on that expense to the consumer for the most part, right? And so in being able to optimize that, having more sales on the aggregator channels wasn't a deterioration of our profitability in our brand. And so by not having that and by having an economic model, by the way, Capriati's, in my opinion, and what I know about the industry, we have an extraordinary economic model. Like our four-wall EBITDA, our four-wall profitability, and our top-line sales in the sandwich space is better than all of our competitors. So we already have this great economic model, and we were able, because we have price elasticity, in my opinion, because of the quality that we're serving. You know, we're not bound by an assembly line, and we sell the highest quality stuff. And so we believe we have a little bit more price elasticity. So in taking some price to optimize the aggregators, it made a lot of sense for us. So we've been in the position of using them prior. And so when COVID hit, it was like, okay, let's just go out and tell our customers how to use the brand. Let's just remind them what channels exist to use the brand. I think the only innovation that really came out of it is we had a lot of franchisee innovation of curbside pickup and figuring out how to do that safely, you know, and make the customer understand that, you know, we are wrapping everything to go and that only one set of healthy hands was touching your product. And, you know, we're tempting people, you know, all the things that all the brands ultimately did to communicate to the guests that we really, you know, have their health and best interest in mind. But besides that, we just went back to what we already had in place and said, let's rely on them. And that was really game changing for us. And again, you know, the catering did go away. We are starting to see it come back now on a very, very micro level. And we expect, you know, to push hard and heavy to go back and get those sales when the time comes. But that's what we did. And that's how we, you know, we weathered it.
Can you say now, I don't know if all your units are open now for dine-in?
Yeah.
And what is your percentage of sales coming from delivery or off-premise overall? Can you say?
I'll get this wrong, but I'll get close. We still are probably about 75% to go, takeout, delivery, or off-premise.
Wow. Yeah.
75% of our business is eaten. But you know, that conversion, it's getting more, you know, kind of getting back to the middle, to the median, you know, every day.
Right.
But, you know, look, in spending a year of time changing consumer behavior, you know, and the consumer didn't want to necessarily change their behavior, but it happened nonetheless. I do think that people figured out how to use Capriati's, you know, in a more efficient way than they were prior. And I, you know, look, even from myself, you know, there are brands that I used to use on a weekly basis that I'd go to, sit, have lunch, kind of have a social experience. And I don't do it as much anymore, even though I can, you know. I just found that the extra hour of my time is just more efficient for me to have that time versus driving back and so forth. So I do think that's, you know, that's a common learning for everybody.
So you mentioned, I think you have two units with drive-throughs. Is that something that, you know, we've seen so many brands now try to work this model into their formats. Is that something you're thinking about doing?
Yeah, we go back and forth. Honestly, Capriati's is a made-to-order brand. We are not preparing food in advance. And so, you know, it is difficult to get the throughput out of a drive-thru that customers would expect. And so in order for us to do it effectively, we do have two that are testing. They're more a pickup window, honestly, than a drive-thru. Yes, you can place your order, but it's not, there's no squawk box. There's no menu out there. It really is designed to be a pickup, you know, order ahead and pick it up. But we are, you know, we are always looking to simplify our system. We are always looking to speed up our service. And, you know, I do think that there is some great automation coming down the pipeline that, you know, we'll see over the next 5 years that, you know, may provide a vehicle for us to, you know, get our speed of service at a level that a drive-thru could handle. And if so, of course, we'll be open to it. You know, because certainly we do think that drive-through is a very big deal. It's definitely not going away. You know, certainly a big opportunity. But at this point, I would not say Capriati's is ready to roll out drive-through.
Okay. Well, let me bring you to the menu, because this is something that you also did during 2020. You had some, you know, some interesting menu innovation for the sandwich space. You have a plant-based cheesesteak, which seems like an oxymoron, but it works. And Wagyu subs, which are cool. Tell us about what you've done with the menu.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, these were not things that we created in 2020, obviously. You know, as you can imagine, brands have innovation pipelines and things take time. And so in 2019, we quickly decided that, you know, as Beyond Meat and Impossible and all these, you know, kind of this disruptive plant-based food came out and it was really good, we started testing it and trying to see if we could make it our own. And we landed on this Impossible cheesesteak. And I will tell you that, you know, when you add the mushrooms, the onions, and the peppers, and we prepare it the way we do, and we season it the way we do, it is 99% as good as a regular cheesesteak, which is crazy because, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. But the reality is it really does. I mean, with the hint, you know, maybe there's a tiny hint of sunflower seed in it, you know, maybe at the end of a bite. But besides that, it really is an exceptional product. And so we had that ready to launch. In addition, you know, again, Capriotti's is very culinary focused. You know, the goal is that every sandwich you order, no matter what it is, I don't care if it's one of our top performers, right? We're known for the Bobby, we're known for the cheesesteak, we're known for the capistrami. But if you go 18 sandwiches down the menu, every single one is curated so that it tastes extraordinary. And we're constantly looking at you know, the food being, you know, what makes us extraordinary. Our food is our franchise. And so, you know, when we looked across at all of our beef products, and we look at all of our proteins on a regular basis, our turkey is butterball grade A turkey with one ingredient, right? And so there is no higher quality turkey in America. You cannot buy a better quality product and you cannot buy a cleaner ingredient list. Well, our beef historically was choice top round with no ingredient list, right? It was just a choice top round 20-pound beef that we would prep and cook in house, and when then, you know, a few years ago this Wagyu craze kind of showed up to the party, and you know, there was this next highest quality meat that was better than just, you know, choice or prime, you know, beef, and it was this idea of Wagyu. And obviously there's Japanese A5 Wagyu that costs $1 zillion an ounce, and there's no way it's ever going to be in quick service,
right?
But then in America, the highest grade beef in America is an American Wagyu. And so we went after trying to figure out if that's now the new gold standard. Let's go figure out how we can implement the new gold standard in Capriotti's, because that's who we are. We're the best. That's what we do. And so we figured out how to bring Snake River Farms, you know, that's the highest quality Wagyu producer in America. You know, Thomas Keller made them famous by using it in his Michelin star restaurants. And, you know, they really do have the most extraordinary beef that's grown in America. We did a deal with them and we were able to put three Wagyu sandwiches on our menu. And no, they don't cost $55 a sandwich. They actually are, you know, virtually the same price. It's a $1 difference. And so, you know, you can get a regular cheesesteak for $8.99, you can get a Wagyu cheesesteak for $9.99. So it really isn't, you know, it doesn't price everybody out, but it is the most unbelievable sandwich I've ever eaten. You can cut it with a fork, literally the whole sandwich with the bread and the meat, and it's decadent. So in doing that, we had that ready to launch as well for 2020, and then COVID hit. And the idea being, you know, what do we do now, right? And so first we went back into survival mode, but again, as I told you, you know, about May, we realized we were going to survive. And now how do we win? And we thought, you know what we're going to do? Let's pretend COVID isn't a thing. Let's just pretend it doesn't exist. And let's just go run our business, put blinders on and go run our business and show the world that not only do we mean business, but we are going to continue to execute at the level at which you would expect us to execute. And so we launched them. And we just changed our narrative and our marketing from, you know, we didn't change it much. It's still, you know, safe, healthy to go. But now you can also get these two extraordinary products. And we thought, you know, what a way to kind of say to our guests, you know, we're here for you. We're continuing to innovate. We're continuing to bring you some goodness out of a potentially terrible situation. You know, try something new, try something more extraordinary than we had before. And again, we saw tremendous success from it. Our Impossible cheesesteak is you know, very well received by a vegetarian guest and or our guest that, you know, the doctor said, hey, you have high cholesterol, just cut back a little bit on the red meat, right? And you can still get this great cheesesteak. And so that worked really well. And Wagyu, again, it's, if you like decadent flavor, if you really, you know, if you like that fine dining feel, this is the sandwich for you. You know, some people I know who have had it say it's, you know, it's rich and, you know, it's decadent. That's the best way I can describe it. So if that's for you, I mean, look, once we put it on our menu, I stopped eating the regular cheesesteak and now all I can do is eat the Wagyu cheesesteak. So for me, it's the most extraordinary thing we've done. But
what's your top seller?
The cheesesteak, but the collector cheesesteak. Yeah. If you look at across cheesesteak, you know, is the highest selling item that we have. The Bobby is obviously a close second, and you know, from there it's Italian capistrano. They're fighting for third.
Yeah. Okay. So now I'm sure the pandemic is inspired this next thing I want to ask you about, which is the push into ghost kitchens. And so can you explain a little bit about what Capriati's is doing with this? And by ghost kitchen, explain what you mean by that term, because people use it differently.
Yeah, sure. So the way I define ghost kitchen is a non-retail kitchen that serves food primarily through delivery aggregators or through online channels of delivery. So you can't walk up and grab your food in a ghost kitchen. It is not retail. You can't walk in and pick it up.
Right.
So that's my definition of ghost kitchen. I think everybody, you know, knows that in certain markets, suburban markets, New York City, Manhattan, Chicago, downtown Chicago, LA, San Francisco, you know, downtown Philly, real estate in DC, real estate has gotten so expensive, retail real estate, that they really have priced out fast food. They've really priced out QSR almost entirely. And really the only things that can make it in that area are retail or upscale casual fine dining. And so, you know, whether that's good or bad, you know, is debatable for another day, but the reality is that's the world we live in. And so, you know, I think again, out of necessity, you know, comes innovation, right? And so, you know, quick service brands and to-go restaurants have said, we cannot make it inside of these markets. And we've tried, but you know, our brand does not allow a $200 per year per square foot rent. It just doesn't work. We'd have to charge $25 for the sandwich to make it work. And so at the end of the day, these ghost kitchens, when we saw the very first couple, you know, get started in New York City, we kind of paid attention to it and said, if this works, this is a way for us to kind of get in to those urban markets and be able to have an economic model that works. And so, you know, I think that the stars aligned. It was one potential benefit for the industry when COVID kind of hit, is that the world now had to be delivery only, right? And so, and so then we said, okay, well, if this is the case, what a better time to test this theory than right now, because we have the most amount of customers willing to use aggregators and use delivery. And so we opened a few ghost kitchens. We now have about a dozen in our chain, and we are seeing, you know, success in these markets. And we execute now in Pasadena, we execute in downtown LA, we execute in downtown Philly, and a myriad of other places. New York City, we have stores now. In Chicago, we have them in places that we would have never been able to go before, and now we're in it. And we're optimizing that line of the business. I do think it's early, and I think we're going to get a lot smarter. But I do think there's a great economic model here for those who want to execute it.
And are you using Reef for all of these locations, or is it depending on the location you find the right
partner? Yeah, no, we're not exclusively one provider. We have Cloud Kitchens, we have Kitchen United, we have Reefs, we have other ones that are not part of that, of the kind of the big three. It really, for us, just depends on the opportunity, depends on the location, depends on the franchise partners willing to open. You know, there's a myriad of factors, but we do not limit it to just one specific ghost kitchen provider.
And generally, when you do this, do you open it up to franchisees that have brick and mortar stores that want to expand their reach into new markets? Or are you opening this to franchisees who just want to do the delivery only model in a certain market? Both? Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. So it really just gives them more options, another way in, depending on where they want to go. Okay. Anything more that you want to say about Wing Zone going forward? Now, we've been talking about 2020, but now that you have this new Wings brand, perhaps that's something you're going to be adding in, also expanding virtual brand opportunities with that brand?
Yeah, absolutely. So you know, look, Wing Zone, you know, we made the acquisition, we closed on it at the beginning of the year. So we're still really, getting our feet kind of under us with respect to what we bought. We're also, you know, we've turned on franchise development, and you know, we are seeing really, really good momentum there. We've sold 40 new restaurants in the last 5 months to 15 new territories, 20 new territories. We have we believe it will end the year with 100 in development and in the pipeline. So we've seen franchise development really there, which allows us to have clarity on the forward investment that the brand needs to really become a national brand. And so we are using that trajectory to now start to forward invest. We're going to do a whole reconcepting of the brand, from looking at everything from food to logo to design, to the real estate model. And even, this brand, it's so much simpler than Capriotti's. So Capriotti's really is a restaurant. You know, it's not an assembly line. You are prepping, you are cooking, you are doing so many facets of a restaurant that it really is this little QSR machine, but it is a restaurant. And so you need culinary, you will eventually become a restaurateur when you become a franchisee of Capriotti's. You're going to learn everything about the restaurant business. In the Wing Zone, it's a lot more simple. You know, Wing Zone is really four items, right? It's bone-in wings, it's boneless wings, it's chicken tenders, and it's fries and some other side items. So it's a very simple operation. And where we're really going with the brand, we actually are thinking that, in looking at the past and seeing the disruption that's occurred through COVID, we actually believe the future is going to be even more disruptive in terms of automation and in terms of, having technology help your business. And so we're going to be very much more tech focused at Wing Zone. There's a universe we'll have cashierless stores very quickly and really just have the order and customer experience up front really happen before you walk in the front door. Additionally, we will have automation in the back of the house. And so we go to test on some automation, over the next couple of months, where we will have, frying robots in the back of the house doing a lot of the fry work. And so there, ultimately we aim to have end-to-end automation in the back of the house and have a cashierless system up front. So it's really a tech focused concept at the end. We're unsure how we land right now. We don't know exactly, where we are, but we are going to be on the forefront of that stuff for that brand, for sure.
That's fantastic. Is it something you might start testing this year, as soon as this year, or down the road?
We'll begin testing in August, yes.
Fantastic, yeah. Can you say where?
We don't know yet.
Okay.
Most likely, Nevada would for sure be up there. We will have the newest, best version of Wing Zone inside of Nevada first.
Okay.
Because that's what we're...
All right. Well, more to come on that. So, Ashley, thank you so much for spending this time and telling us about how well it went last year. I really appreciate you taking this time with me, and best wishes to you.